He'd been to a lot of places here and elsewhere, but he hadn't been everywhere. So south it was. Hey folks, how you doing? Keith Tyler's with you, bringing you the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I truly appreciate you joining me. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Andrew Welsh Huggins brings us our first story, and it's called So South It Was. He called her Red, after the color of her hair, but it wasn't her real name. No one seemed to know what that was or care all that much, or where she was from or where she was going, though you could have said the same thing for almost any of them. When he first arrived, Dell asked her a couple of times what they should call her, but she just shook her head like she was trying to rid herself of a bothersome fly, and he let it go. He figured she wanted her privacy, which was fine by him. People didn't end up here by winning a popularity contest. It was only after a week that Jackie P. filled him in, having figured it out first. The issue wasn't Red's name. It was the fact that she couldn't, or wouldn't, talk. Dell put her late teens, early 20s, little thing, favoring bright cotton dresses and leggings, even out here. Occasionally, she'd wear her lone sweatshirt, Talladega across the chest, if the nights grew cool. Pale skin, thin cheeks, sprayed with freckles, curly hair the color of bricks after rain that she kept short with a pair of pinking shears. Little thing, but not exactly a shrinking violet. He watched her march into camp one day with a full, unopened 5-gallon water jug she found someplace. Her arm muscles ropey like taut cords. When he went to help, he nearly fell over from the container's weight. When Larry and Lawrence, lounging in their folding chairs, asked her where she found it, she just pointed. She might have meant Third Street, she might have meant Australia. You just never knew with Red. Nobody knew why she didn't talk, and after a while they just accepted it. Red had a bike that she rode just about everywhere. Dark green frame, blue Schwinn seat with a crack in it so that you could see the cushion inside. Flat handlebars with gray duct tape around the ends that was starting to fray. Nobody knew where she went. They just knew Red was a roamer. She stored the bike in her tent when she wasn't riding, which offended some people at first, like she thought one of them would steal it. Like they weren't all in this together? Then Ellie Dembinski lost her temper one day and said something about it, and Red flipped her the bird and took off, and they didn't see her for nearly a week. When she finally returned, wheeling the bike down the wooded path, her yellow dress, her favorite, was torn at the shoulder. Her face was grimy with dust and rivulets of sweat crossed her cheeks like faded warrior markings. Ellie Dembinski started to say something, but before she finished a sentence, Red dumped her backpack by the fire, and everyone stared at the pile of fresh apples. Packages of granola bars and beef jerky, shiny Capri Sun juice drinks, and 6 still partially frozen steaks, and 2 packages of fully charged burner cell phones. Nobody said anything about where Red stored her bike after that. They also remembered how she nearly drowned trying to retrieve it from the river after the attack. They showed up around midnight, far as Dell could tell, since he hadn't had time to look at his watch. Set a bivouac in the dark places you can't pronounce, and with strict instructions to stow all electronics enough times, you learn to gauge the hours within a couple of minutes either way. 4 of them, stumbling down the path and into the encampment, using their phone lights to guide them, Oh, big guys, drunk as skunks, in golf shirts and shorts, straight from the bars up on High Street, he figured. How they found them was anybody's guess. Though all the construction in and around campus in recent years had encroached on the hidden camp and brought it closer and closer to people. Dell was coming back from taking a leak, otherwise he might not have seen them at all first. "What do you want?"
Gotta go, man," the first one said, slurring his words. Not the tallest in the group, but the one with the biggest smile, showing off enamel as blindingly white as something out of a toothpaste ad in one of Ellie Dembinski's fashion magazines she liked to read after dinner. He stepped forward, unzipped his jeans, and urinated on what was left of the fire.
"Hey, don't be pussies," he said, jerking his head in the others. "Give me a hand here."
As Dell watched in amazement, all four were soon pissing on the flames, snickering as they directed their flow in zigzag patterns while rank steam filled the air.
"Hey, you have to leave," Dell said.
Enamel laughed, stumbling backward a step as he finished, then making a production of zipping up. The other three laughed too, though not quite as loudly. One of them, a thick-waisted kid with soft brown eyes and a baby face, covered in blonde fuzz, looked the slightest bit nervous, like a kid on Halloween following his pals into a graveyard 20 minutes after his parents told him to be home.
"Hey, maybe you're the one who needs to leave, Obama.
I live here."
"Is that what you call it?"
Enamel said, and before Dell could reply, he kicked Dell's folding chair, bouncing it toward the nearest tree. The action triggered something in the rest, a silent signal that needed no words, and before Dell could stop them, they were kicking the remaining chairs, landing some in the smoking remains of the fire, and sending others into tents, ringing the fire pit and still lofting others into the trees and down toward the river. They hooted and hollered as they worked, and as Dell tried to stop them, a thin kid with droopy eyes and a weak chin pushed him away. Fuzzface laughed as Dell fell to the ground, unable to keep his balance. From there, a kind of frenzy overtook them, a spell cast by alcohol and adrenaline, and they fanned out across the encampment, knocking over piles of belongings, stacked outside tents, overturning milk crates, playing catch with the small bottles of propane that Jackie P. used for cooking. At one point, Droopy Eyes had the bright idea of pulling up tent stakes, and before Dell could stop them, they were attacking the shelters themselves. All the while, Dell noticed the fourth kid, a happy-go-lucky type with a wig of black hair. He kept pushing out of his eyes, had his phone up, filming. Larry and Lawrence were the first ones awakened, fear quickly pasting over curiosity in their eyes as they peeked out of their tent and looked to Dell for guidance. A moment later, Jackie P. stuck her head out. When he saw what was happening, he emerged slowly and stiffly, and then, as if energized by an electric jolt, burst into the middle of the chaos, screaming and waving his arms and yelling for them to stop. Three of them did, just for a moment. But Enamel walked up to him and, without warning, cold-cocked him on the side of the head. Jackie P. fell hard, and Enamel kicked his head twice, his smile fixed like a shark. Then Weak Chin and Phone Guy joined him, and after a second even Fuzzface gave a half-hearted swipe with his left foot, though it seemed like he wasn't really up for it. As they attacked, Jackie P. moaned, twisting this way and that, holding his hands over his face as he tried to protect himself. Dell was righting himself and preparing to charge when he heard someone say, "Hey!" And all of a sudden, things fell quiet. He watched as Ellie Dembinski struggled to crawl out from her half-collapsed tent.
"What the heck's going on?"
As she came into view, a pair of wolf whistles broke the silence.
"Holy cow, would you look at her," Enamel said.
Dell looked first at the young men and then at Ellie Dembinski, and his heart skipped a beat. He saw what they were staring at.
He stared at it himself when he first arrived, although he got over it after a day or two. She could fill out her clothes, was what they were seeing. She was all there, in all the right places. The nights had been hot recently, the smell of the river behind them rising up, fetid and dank, and she'd taken to wearing just an oversized t-shirt to sleep in, though it still only came down to mid-thigh. First thing in the morning, she'd put on a pair of sweatpants, but there wasn't time for that tonight. Ellie Dembinski was probably the age of their mothers, and she had a hard face to go with her full figure. But Dell was pretty sure the young men weren't counting on the years or looking at her face.
"Well, hey, sweetheart," Enamel said. "What's going on?"
She shook her head at the mess she saw, disappeared inside her tent, and emerged a moment later with a baseball bat.
"Get the hell out of here!" "Yeah?" Enamel said. "About that?"
The next couple of minutes were a blur of shouts and screams. The men moved en masse toward Ellie Dembinski, Enamel leading the charge, the guy with the phone at the rear capturing everything. She took a swing at Enamel's head as he came within range, but even in his drunken state he twisted quickly enough that it landed on his shoulder instead. Oh, it must have hurt, though, because he yelped and grabbed the bat and handed it to Weak Chin, and then he said something Dell couldn't hear, and suddenly Weak Chin and Fuzz Face were on their knees holding Ellie Dembinski down, while Enamel was making a sound someplace between a snarl and a laugh and unbuckling his pants, and then a long, low, guttural sound like a scrape of a chair being dragged across a hard floor froze them all. Dell looked up just in time to see Red striding in the shadows across the encampment, her bike raised impossibly high over her head, almost as if it were hooked to invisible overhead cables, and before anyone knew what was happening, she hurled it at the knot of attackers with all her strength. It wasn't like one bike. Even tossed with the force that Red unleashed was going to take out a quartet of full-grown men. But Fuzzface took the brunt of the impact on the front wheel on his forehead and gave a little moan as he stepped back. He tripped in a way that caused both him and Weak Chin to go over, landing on Emmanuel as he struggled with his zipper. The disturbance broke their concentration, and a moment later, Enamel was howling as Ellie Dembinski sunk her teeth into his forearm, hanging on like a dog on a haunch of meat while she pummeled his chest with her fists. Dell took advantage of the confusion to rush forward and grab her baseball bat and start swinging, and some of the old juices flowed as he made contact with chins and elbows and heads. Over and over again, thwack, thwack, thwack. One of them, possibly Fuzzface, was yelling at him to stop, that they didn't mean anything, that they were just messing around. At one point, as they fought back, Dell took a fist to the head. As he went down, he saw Weak Chin wrestling with Red for her bike before, with a triumphal shout, he wrestled it free, moved around her, and threw it down the hill and into the river, where it landed with a small splash. Red gave a little squeak, and Adele's surprise slapped the young man, and before he could react, crashed down the hill after her bike.
Let's go, Weak Chin said, and although Enamel shot him a look, he was also bleeding and having difficulty standing up straight.
A moment later, kicking more of Dell's and everyone else's remains up and down the camp, they departed. The young men were gone, heading up the trail and onto the path and back into the direction of campus. Catching his breath, Dell knew he should try to help Red, and he moved in that direction, but in the end, it was Ellie Dembinski who rushed past him and braved the water in nothing but her t-shirt and helped pull Red and her bike to safety. Afterward, Jackie P. wasn't doing too good. His skin was clammy and his breathing shallow, and a knot the size of a bruised tangerine swelled on the side of his head. Larry said he needed to go to the hospital, and Lawrence said that they should call the police. Ellie Dembinski said screw the police, And Red, well, didn't say anything at all, but just sat and held Ellie Dembinski's hand and brushed out her hair with long, slow, gentle strokes. Del knew Larry was right, but he also wasn't sure about moving Jackie P. He'd seen guys in that condition before, and it was going to take more than this bunch to shift him to safety. Del also wondered how far the four guys had gone. And as angry as he was with Ellie Dembinski on the subject of the cops. Look what happened the last time, when they'd called 911 after a different set of kids decided to finish their Saturday night by rousting their camp. The cops rousted them after running their names and turning up a pair of misdemeanors. So they decided to make Jackie P. comfortable, giving him some water and setting him up with blankets and a pillow right where he lay, and assigning themselves to an impromptu overnight vigil. Exhausted by the night events, one by one they fell asleep. By the time gray light filtered through the trees the next morning, Jackie P. was gone, skin gray and flesh cold, lips parted in a way that almost looked like a smile. Then they had to call the cops, but they made sure they were long gone, hiding far back in the thick woods, abutting the river, when the paramedics in blue and the officers in black stepped cautiously into the clearing. Larry and Lawrence disappeared after that. Del heard they'd found a camp on the south end, hidden back by the Scioto, and decided to stay there. He knew the area a little. Had worked at a garage there once, and figured it was as good as any place to land. Ellie Dembinski called her sister, and after a loud, angry exchange over the phone, she gathered up her belongings, stuffed them in pillowcases, threw those in a shopping cart, and pushed it up the hill onto the trail and headed past the stadium and over to Lane Avenue, where Del, following to make sure she was okay, watched a heavy-set woman pull up in a van and stand with her hands on her hips doing squat while Ellie Dembinski loaded her bags inside. Del thought about heading back west. Now the heck with it, or maybe north, even to Canada, where he'd always wanted to visit. But after he saw that Red wasn't going anywhere, he decided to stay put for a while. They stayed hidden for a couple of weeks. Twice more they watched, keeping way back in the woods, as the young men returned to the now empty encampment, some of the originals and a couple of new guys, disappointment etched on their faces when they didn't find what they were looking for. Then two more weeks passed, and they didn't come around at all. Then a young couple, guy and a gal, took up residence where Jackie P. had set his tent, followed by a woman who seemed to be a friend of theirs. And then another guy came, and Del figured it was safe to return, although he also figured it was only a matter of time before the young men showed up again. And then one day, an hour or so before midnight, Del was awakened by Red, jostling his shoulder. What is it? She gestured at a pair of sycamores whose wide trunks marked the boundary of the camp. There, leaning beside Red's bike, was another bike, just Del's size. Who knew where she found it, or how she wheeled it down while dealing with her own? That was the thing about Red. You never really knew. She roamed and came back, and that was it. Once more she gestured at Del and then back to the bike, and the message was clear. They were going someplace. The moon was out that night and visibility was passable, which was a good thing because Del wasn't exactly sure where they were headed. Sometimes as the trail wound closer to the highway, he caught a glow of streetlights, but still, it was like riding in a dream, whose ending you didn't know. It was cooler tonight, autumn and all, and Red wore her Talladega sweatshirt over a thin blue dress, and over that, her backpack, the one with a cartoon alligator on the front flap. Eventually, they emerged onto Broad and from there maneuvered onto side streets west of downtown. Red rode on the wrong side of the street facing traffic, but Dell decided not to correct her and just gave her a little distance as they traveled. It's not like a lot of people were around that time of night. A bunch of new buildings had gone up in the neighborhood in recent years, 10, 12, 14 stories and more. A different Columbus than the one Dell knew as a kid. But the shadows the buildings cast fell not all that far from a lot of old houses he did remember. Wood frames crowded next to one another along narrow streets, beaters parked up and down the side. They rode for several minutes through the early morning darkness, and then Red stopped at one of those houses. A bungalow set back from the street, almost hidden by an alley, with cracked windows and a small garden growing from the gutters hanging haphazardly from eaves. Red wheeled her bike into the yard through grass almost to her knees and went around to the right and into the back where a large brick building blocked the view of passers-by on the next street over. She laid the bike down and gestured for Dell to do the same. "What are we doing?" Dell whispered. Without replying, Red walked to the cracked and crumbling concrete steps by the back door. But instead of mounting them, she moved to her left, knelt, and as Dell watched in amazement, disappeared through a hole once filled by a basement window. Arms, then head, then torso, then legs, as if the house were swallowing her whole. After a moment, Dell followed with difficulty, one aching limb after another. When he finally made it inside, feeling like he'd fallen from a tree, she was waiting for him in the middle of the basement, which smelled of mildew and garbage and animal scat, her eyes shining from the glint of a lone street lamp outside. "What is this place?" Red pointed across the room and started walking, stepping around piles of wood and bricks and shards of smash bottles, boots crunching as she went, and led him up the stairs, which creaked as they ascended, as if they were stepping on something alive. They entered into the kitchen, and Dell smelled it right away, grabbing the edge of the door frame to steady himself. Good God! What had she gotten him into? He wanted to stop Red, tell her they should go back, explain that this was a bad idea, a really bad idea. But she was already through the kitchen and gone. The two men were in the living room, or at least what was left of them. It might only have been 2 or 3 days since it went down, and temperatures had fallen, sure, but they were already pretty far gone. Maggots writhed in their wounds, and to judge by the state of their faces and necks and hands, there'd been animals on them, no question. The two of them separated maybe by 10 feet, one closest to the couch, lying on his side in the fetal position, hands out of sight. Dell guessed he survived his injuries just long enough to fool himself into thinking he might be all right. The other flat on his back beside an overturned chair, gun still in his right hand. On the table, 2 bricks of white powder. Not hard to guess what went down here. But how in the world did Red find them? And what were she and he doing back here? As if hearing his thoughts, Red tugged at his elbow and led him to the table. She pointed at what he'd missed before, parked on the wooden chair nearest the kitchen, a large army green duffel bag, partially unzipped. Dell peered inside and found himself staring at pack after pack of $100 bills, his mind reeled trying to estimate how much cash he was looking at. Enough for a trip west or north 5 times over. Before he knew what was happening, Red took off her alligator backpack and pulled out a second pack, which she'd stuffed inside. This one decorated with palm trees and happy-faced suns. She handed it to him, pointed at the duffel bag, and methodically filled her own pack with bundle after bundle after bundle.
Red, no!
She shook her head and continued loading up.
It's too dangerous!
She shook her head again, pulled the palm tree backpack from his hands, balanced it on the chair beside hers, and then alternated her efforts, one bundle in hers, one bundle in his. Eventually, Del gave up and joined in. Even with both packs filled to bursting, heavy as sacks of creek stones, at least a third of the money remained in the duffel bag. Del made to leave, but Red was ready for this, too. She pulled string bags out of each of the pockets of her dress, handed one to Del, and they filled those as well. This time, they got nearly all of it. She showed him how to loop the string bag over his head so it rode on his chest like a baby in a backpack.
"We should go."
She nodded, but instead of leaving, walked to the man lying on his back. By the overturned chair, looked at Del and pointed at his gun.
"No, oh no."
She nodded, keeping her eyes on him and not the weapon.
"Well, we can't. The money, well, that's bad enough."
She put her hands on her narrow waist and held his gaze until he dropped his eyes.
"These were bad men, Red. If someone finds out..."
She didn't answer, but just kept staring at him. At last, deciding things couldn't get any worse than they already were, he inched forward toward the body, gagging at the smell, and bent over. He looked at the gun, rose, went to the duffel bag, and pulled a single Benjamin from one of the last packs remaining. Folding it in half, using it as a kind of a napkin, Del gingerly lifted the gun out of the man's hands, the rigor that had held it tight long gone. For all the mess and death in the room, the gun was clean, no blood, a semi-automatic. Carefully, Del lowered it onto the table. He studied it for a moment, then removed the magazine, the movement coming back to him, a muscle memory he'd long suppressed, and saw it was 12 plus 1, with 3 gone. He removed the chamber round and placed it and the magazine in his pocket. Red moved across the room and pointed at the second man. It took a minute for Del to find the gun. It was in the corpse's hands, both of which were wedged between his knees, as though he'd placed it there to warm as his life ebbed away. Blood pooled over it, and the weapon seemed to shimmer with the twisting mass of larvae coming to consume the man's abdomen. And Del shook his head and rose. He'd had enough. To his relief, Red accepted this. A moment later, they were descending the stairs into the basement. The musty air, a relief after the smell upstairs, and then they were climbing up and back out through the window. Red first, then the two backpacks, his with the gun inside, then the two string bags, then Del. They rode home in the dark, traveling up Broad on the wrong side of the street again until they crossed to the bike path. Struggling with the weight of their burden, bikes wobbling a bit as they traveled. Once back in camp, they split the money evenly for safekeeping, a backpack and a string bag for each. But Del made Red take the gun. He wanted nothing more to do with it, and he made it clear he wasn't going to argue the point. For 2 or 3 weeks after that, it was just them, and the young couple, and the young couple's friend, and the other guy, a middle-aged man called Harry, who called himself Scary Harry, because where his left eye should have been was just a scar he kept covered with a patch he rigged from a mask left over from the pandemic. But the funny thing was, Scary Harry wasn't scary at all. He pitched in whenever was needed and was a good one with the jokes. He also had a decent job, working maintenance at the university, and had an easier time keeping his phone charged. He was the one who showed Red and Dell and the others the videos where young guys trashed camps just like theirs and then posted the results online. It was some kind of an internet challenge, he explained. They thought they saw something from the night Jackie P. died. Enamel and Fuzzface and Weakchin's faces blurred, so they couldn't be totally sure. They took a weird solace in the video being posted, being out there, hoping that meant they'd achieved their purpose. Then 2 nights later, the men came back. Dell had taken to sleeping with his backpack as his pillow and with a string bag looped around his feet until he could figure out a better solution to the problem of having so much cash around. Over 200,000 between the two of them. The configuration of bags and his worries about all that money meant he didn't sleep all that good. So he was awake almost as soon as they marched down the path again and entered the camp. 5 of them this time, 2 of them new and looking loaded for bear in their excitement. With them, Enamel, Fuzzface, and Phone Guy. They didn't wait for instructions from Enamel, but just started walking around kicking things and throwing stuff. "Hey, Obama's back," Enamel said as he spied Dell. "Get the heck out of here." "Soon as we say hi to everyone," Enamel said. He looked in frustration at the spot where Ellie Dembinski pitched her tent, but the look faded a little when the young couple's friend peeked out of her tent, groggy and scared. "Well, hey, sweetheart," Enamel said. "What's going on?" As if on cue, the other 4 went quiet. Fuzzface edged up behind Enamel and whispered something to him. Enamel turned with an expression of disgust, as if the kid had spit in his ear, and bade the group follow him toward the woman's tent. They stopped as a sound interrupted them. Dell, out of his tent and ready to defend the woman, followed their gaze. On the edge of the clearing stood Red, stamping her foot as she pointed the gun from the bungalow at Enamel's head. "Oh, no, hey, now," Enamel stopped like a statue in his tracks. Red stamped her foot again and jerked her head to signal them to back away from the woman's tent. "Oh, relax," Enamel said. "We're just joking around is all." "Let's go," Fuzzface said. "We should go." "Shut up and let me handle this." "We really need to get out of here." "I said, let me handle this." The other 3 didn't need persuading. The pair, so excited when they stumbled into the camp, were the first ones out of there, with Phone Guy right behind them by a couple of seconds. "Hey!" Enamel said, yelling in vain at their backs as they disappeared up the trail. Red stamped her feet, gesturing in the direction of the vanishing trio. "Okay, okay," Enamel said, and started to walk away. And then before Red could react, he rushed her, waving his arms like some kind of a crazy man, almost the way Jackie P. had done, and knocked her over. Fuzzface stood motionless, alone in the center of the encampment, a half grin on his face like an actor uncertain whether to bow or rush from the stage. Dell rushed to help Red, limping as fast as he could. He almost made it to the pair when a shot went off and Enamel screamed and fell back, clutching his right thigh. "Oh, man, you shot me!" Red scuttled back, eyes wide, lips parted, breath coming in short, fast bursts. Dell leaned over and took the gun from her hand. He expected to see fear or agitation or uncertainty on her face, but all he saw was a look of fixed determination. "Oh, help me, man, help me. She shot me. She shot me." Dell turned and looked at the young man. He looked a lot younger now. There was plenty of blood, but that didn't always mean it was bad. Dell had seen both. Blood that meant nothing, and nothing, almost a scratch that meant death. Well, they'd find out soon enough.
We were only messing around. What the heck?"
Dell looked up. Fuzzface, standing a few feet away now, arms crossed, looking from his friend to Red to Dell and back, eyes pleading. Dell turned and faced him head on.
"Get out!"
Hey, man, come on. I said, get out.
Dell advanced, gun extended. The kid backed up, looked around for help, but the young couple and their friend just stared. Scary Harry was standing transfixed. Red was withdrawing into himself, and Enamel was moaning as he dragged himself, falling often and rising more slowly each time back up the trail. It wasn't exactly a chase. Dell, trembling in his anger, kept moving forward, and Fuzzface kept backing up until suddenly he was at the edge of the wood by the river. He looked up and down the embankments, as if deciding which way to run, and took another step back and slipped, and before Dell knew what was happening, the boy was in the river, yelping at the cold. The kid sat up as if he wasn't sure where he was, in no more than 8 or 10 inches of water. He tried to stand, but just as he righted himself, he slipped, right where the rocks were the mossiest. The purchase almost impossible, he gave another yelp as his head struck a protruding stone. This time he stayed down, not moving, half submerged in the gently flowing current. "Oh, please," he said with a groan, looking up at Dell, splashing like a fish stuck in the shallows. Dell reared back and threw the gun into the middle of the river. "Please," Fuzzface said. "The water's so cold." Dell thought about walking back up the hill, and then he remembered another river in another country a long time ago. He felt his head clear and the rage inside dissipate like mist under a hot morning sun, and a moment later he waded into the water and reached out his hand. Fuzzface took it, and Dell pulled, but the young man didn't rise, and there was no way Dell had the strength to shift him alone. He just couldn't do it. And then a moment later, he heard a sound, and Red was there, and together they hauled the boy onto the shore where they left him, shivering, tears streaming down his face.
"We were only messing around," he said, raising his arms in expectation of a hand up.
Dell didn't reply, but instead turned and headed back for the camp, Red already a few yards ahead of him. 5 minutes later, Red had the bikes ready, their backpacks beside them. They each helped the other position their packs and the string bags. Without a word, they tossed young couple and their friend and Scary Harry a pack of bills each. Then they wheeled their bikes up the trail and onto the asphalt fitness path. Dell saw slick patches of blood, a lot of it, where Enamel had passed, but there was no sign of the young man himself in any direction. Dell thought about the bus station, but while it might not be the first place the cops looked, well, it wouldn't be the last. They settled on the south end instead, aiming for the garage Dell once worked at, not far from where Larry and Lawrence went. He knew it opened early. He was pretty sure he could buy a car there with very few questions asked. It's not like they didn't have the money. It was 2 in the morning when they reached the place. The front of the store was exposed to traffic on South Parsons, but a dumpster on the side blocked the view well enough. Dell had Red hold the bin's top open while he hoisted the bikes inside and hid them beneath large bags of trash. Done, he fished out a couple of flattened cardboard boxes. He set those up as sleeping mats, and when he was sure they couldn't be seen, they lay down, backpacks for pillows and string bags by their feet, to catch a little sleep before dawn. Shifting a bit, trying to make himself comfortable, he said in a quiet voice, "Yeah, maybe we should go west or north." A second passed, and another. Red's deep, even breathing made him think she'd already fallen asleep.
"South."
He pushed himself up on his elbow and stared at her. "What did you say?"
"I said south."
He sat up all the way. "So you can talk." She shrugged. "So south, not west, not north?" She nodded. "You sure?" She nodded again. After a moment, Dell lay down. He thought
He'd been to a lot of places here and elsewhere, but he hadn't been everywhere. So south it was. Alright, I'm going to stay in that same Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. We're going to move over to their Department of First Stories. And this story is written by Manon Wogan, and it's called Kanab Noon. The road is narrow and dry. No signs, no conspicuous landmarks. It looks like any other dirt road in southwestern Utah. Arid, brick red, punctuated with cacti and hardy shrubs. Had Dave Warren not been here before, he would have missed the turn entirely. The 40-odd years he'd been gone had little effect on the landscape, even the town of Kanab. Dave discovers is as he remembers, mostly churches and museums and Wild West restaurants for tourists. Modest, sleepy, a snapshot in time. Dave is pretty sure that the motel he's staying at hasn't seen a paintbrush since World War II. The road dead ends into the property. He lurches to a stop, red rocks crunching under the tires of his rental Subaru. Straight ahead is the house. On the right, the old barn, its wooden planks still tired and gray. In a sunken ditch to the left is a rusted, hollowed-out 1947 Chevy pickup. The same truck Dave once drove up and down that narrow dirt road, moving bales and hauling junk, and at one point carting a dead horse to a suitable gravesite in the mountains where the earth was soft and easy to dig. Oh, he shudders. It's not a treasured memory. None of that summer really is, though. Not like other teenage summers of swimming and ice cream and laughter. There was no pool here, no money for sweets, and nothing to laugh at. Summers were supposed to be going by quickly. This one felt like a year. Dave thought his mother sending him here was a punishment akin to hell. Manual labor in hot-as-sin Utah under the supervision of Uncle Clarence, for whom almost nothing was worthy of praise, was a far cry from the teenage summer he felt he deserved. Instead of enjoying the sunshine, he resented it. And yet, while Dave doesn't miss the work, there is something to be said about the simplicity of it all. Takes on a different light now, of course, in that strange way old memories do. Only time is kind enough to help you realize what something meant to you and how it shaped and molded your path. At age 17, Dave Warren never wanted to see this place again. At age 66, he has a certain respect for it. Uncle Clarence's home still sits on its original foundation. It was one of the few things that earned Clarence Debrecht's approval. In 1889, stone base that never faltered or crumbled. It was already 80 years old when Dave lived here by now. It's well over 100. He pictures the interior, a small main room with a kitchen and sitting area and a back door. One bedroom where Clarence slept. Dave stayed with Martin in the basement, which, while dismal, kept them cool during the summer heat. There was no bathroom anywhere inside. In the distance, the old outhouse slumps in the dirt. Dave hopes it's been as unused as it looks. Admiring the whitewashed house, gleaming bright against the desert rocks, Dave kills the engine. The silence invites more memories. The dug deep splinters he earned while attempting to resuscitate that crumbling wood barn. A failed project that earned him a chewing out. Uncle Clarence's unsalted utilitarian meals of hard meat and little else. Martin swinging a freshly dead rattlesnake around his neck like a feather boa until Uncle Clarence yanked it off.
"You'll kill yourself playing around here like that, boy,"
Uncle Clarence hollered loud enough for the neighbors over the mountain to hear. Martin went red from neck to ears, from embarrassment or with anger. Dave couldn't tell. To a 17-year-old kid, Uncle Clarence was just about as mean as a man could get. 6'5", with a neatly trimmed crop of white hair, a clean-shaven face textured with deep lines and pale scars. He dressed in beaver fur Stetsons and pencil straight-line blue jeans and spoke with a quiet drawl, with whistled W's that suggested an Oklahoma childhood. Dave always believed he saved up his voice until he needed it most. Soft-spoken until provoked, and no one provoked him like Martin. A rattlesnake boa was angelic compared to what else Martin accomplished that summer. Stealing the truck for late-night drives, shoddy work on easy jobs, a fistfight with the bishop's son down the road. The threat of eternal damnation didn't faze him, nor did his father's punishments. But they faze Dave, and as he sits here in front of the old house, he feels the same trepidation and dread he felt back then. Like any move he makes could be criticized, found fault with, even now. Funny how feelings always come back with the memories. Well, Uncle Clarence is long gone now. When Dave lived here, Clarence, in his own words, already had one boot in the grave. Dave realizes with sudden horror that he must be close to the same age now as the old man was then. Martin is, well, Dave doesn't know what happened to Martin. As a kid, his cousin couldn't resist trouble, and he only got worse with age. Last Dave heard, he had been arrested for armed robbery. Before that, there was a rumor of assault and battery that his family shoved under the rug. No one likes a black sheep. With a father like Clarence Debrecht, it wasn't hard to imagine why Martin would turn out the way he did. There was no pleasing Clarence. Perhaps Martin was right to quit trying. Dave leans back against the headrest, unsure what to do next. Knock on the door. The local said no one has lived here for years. The house looks like it, too. Old, empty, quiet. A gunshot echoes against the red hills. Dave lurches forward, his heart rocking into his throat. He scans the landscape. A sound like that could travel. Maybe it came from the next ranch over, which is so far away Dave can barely see the top of the buildings on the horizon. As much as Dave wants to blame a neighbor, the shot sounded closer, like it came from inside Uncle Clarence's house. Dave looks around again. He's still the only one in sight. It takes longer than Dave would like to scramble out of the car and reach for the front door. He knocks, still tentative. The door creaks open on rusty springs. Hello? The house is dark and cool, despite the noon heat. Dave steps inside and steadies himself against the doorframe while his eyes adjust to the abrupt shade. He registers the boots first, and the person wearing them second. A man, aged and wiry, is lying on his back, a still-smoking revolver by his side. Despite the white hair, the dark blood that pools around his head and sticks to his cheeks, and the decades that has passed since they last spoke, Dave recognizes him. Blue eyes wide and lifeless. Martin Debrecht is here, dead, on his father's tiled floor. Dave Warren stumbles back, chest heaving. A murder? He should call the cops, the paramedics, anybody. But when his trembling hands finally find his cell phone to dial 911, the call immediately fails. No service flashes on the screen. Then comes a rumble, almost familiar. Dave makes a mental promise to come back for poor Martin and runs outside to the bright sun just in time to see the old Chevy heave itself out of the ditch. Oh, man, that thing can still run? He thought it was a scrap metal. The truck rumbles onto the dirt path and disappears in a cloud of dust. Adrenaline kicks in, and with it a sense of duty. Dave jumps back into the car and floors it. As it turns out, the old Chevy can really fly. Dave was almost certain its tires were flat, but they roll easily over the rocks and divots that the new Subaru can just barely handle. Dave focuses on the target as he drives through the dust. There's a man behind the wheel. He can barely make out the silhouette of a tall hat. The dirt road ends, and Dave follows as the Chevy makes a right turn onto the paved highway. He has to speed up to keep pace with the truck, which is now moving faster than sin over the smooth asphalt. Dave's phone buzzes in his pocket. He probably has service now, but he can't reach for it yet. He'll call the police later once he's caught this guy. The road abruptly enters town, the rocks and cacti giving way to low-lying buildings of Kanab. Pedestrians wander and chat, seemingly oblivious to the speeding cars cutting through the main street. The Chevy takes a sudden left, and Dave scrambles to follow, forced to make a hairpin U-turn, narrowly missing a honking sedan. Dave spots the rusted tail end of the truck as it slips around another bend. By the time he catches up, the Chevy is parked halfway up on a red curb, its driver's side door ajar. Dave slams on the brakes and parks behind it. He looks around to find himself across from the old Kanab Cemetery. Nothing tells a town's age quite like its churches and graveyards. Kanab's dead have been buried here for a century and a half, and there are still plots being dug. It's quiet now. No funerals or grieving visitors, which makes it easy to spot the tall figure moving along the grass with a heavy gait. Dave scrambles out of the Subaru, legs weak, and follows the man into the cemetery. It's a pleasant resting place, well-kept and shady, sprawling and flat like the rest of Kanab. Dave moves as quickly as he can, careful to step over the dried flowers and faded American flags stuck reverently in the earth. The man is still in the distance, his bone-white Stetson bobbing in the sun. The hat tilts down as the man pauses, studying a tombstone. The town clock strikes noon. Its bell tolls in the distance. "Hey!" Dave shouts. The cemetery is fenced in. He just about has this man cornered. I know what you did. Don't take another step. At Dave's voice, the man turns slowly. That face, tanned and wizened, and almost familiar. Dave squints, shielding his eyes from the glaring sun. The man is silent as he raises one hand and tips his hat in the subtle acknowledgement. That face! Dave trips over a recessed tombstone. By the time he scrambles to his feet, the man is gone. Dave is running now, panting, his head swiveling, right, left, behind, and ahead. There's no trace of the Stetson. Barely any time has passed. The bell tower is still chiming. He reaches the spot where he last saw him and looks down, as the man had gone only seconds ago. By his feet is a tombstone. It's granite, weather-worn, and nearly unreadable. But even if the stone had been completely smooth with age, Dave realizes he would have known whose grave it marks. Clarence Debrecht, born 1898, died 1975, John 3:15. There's something else, nestled in the grass, at the height of scales. Dave freezes. He shuffles back, heart pounding, breaths uneven, until panic ebbs. It's a rattlesnake. Dead. Dave Warren finds the nearest bar and orders a whiskey neat. This is, of course, after he went back to Uncle Clarence's property. He left the cemetery to find the Chevy gone, the only evidence of his existence the way his Subaru had parked crooked along the red curb. He got in and drove out of town, back into the highway, and made the left onto the narrow dirt road, the whole time his hands clenching tight on the steering wheel. He knew before he got there what he would find. The old Chevy in the ditch, rusted and hollowed out, with four flat tires. A quiet house, looking older and more weathered than it had just a half hour ago, and inside it, an empty room. No body, no revolver, no blood. Dave knew he wouldn't find Martin Debrecht's body. He knew this because at the cemetery he looked over to see Martin's tombstone next to his father's, separated by green grass, the dead snake, and 49 years. Martin died last December. What Dave doesn't know is why he went back to the house to double-check and why he even wanted to see it again in the first place. Patsy Cline is crooning on the jukebox. Crazy, that's how Dave Warren feels. Martin Debrecht's obituary was published online. It is 25 words and contains no illuminating details other than a memorial service that Dave missed by 10 months. He left no relatives, that is, none who were named. Dave's vision blurs as he exits out of the obituary. He turns off his phone and places it face down on the table, opting instead to cradle his drink and listen to Patsy. Tomorrow, he'll leave this town. He'll get back into the Subaru and drive back home. Back to the real world, where he's no longer a 17-year-old kid, and maybe after 100 miles, it'll all make sense. Or maybe, Dave thinks, he'll stop by Uncle Clarence's house again, one last time, before he leaves Kanab for good. Maybe he'll get there right before noon, like he did today, just in time to hear the gunshot, to find the body, to see the old Chevy roar back to life. Maybe he'll follow it again, or maybe he'll let it go. Dave downs his whiskey and pays his tab. There's a hat store down the street, and he'd like to buy a souvenir before it closes. His heart is set on a Stetson, beaver fur, bone white. Well, friends, I'm out of time. This is Keith Tyler saying thank you for joining me here on the Mystery Hour and Sun Sounds of Arizona. Join me again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.